Have y'all come on in, take your shoes off, sit on down.
Y'all listening to
In the Corner, Big by the Woodpile.
During my initial days as a teacher in China, I would often come back to the building they stuck all the non-Chinese in, so frustrated and furious. I laugh at the myself of then, now, but at the time I took very personal my students' incessant cheating, the school administration's deep-seated corruption and apathy, and the communist government's insistence on being praised for creating such a glorious superior country. When I would roll up to the building on my poorly constructed prostate-numbing bicycle, a whimsical British voice would call out from his first apartment kitchen window, "I know that look." That voice belonged to my guest today back by the woodpile, a fellow teacher whom we'll call Mr. Semper. In spite of his own grinding cynicism, 60-something years old, Mr. Semper would always listen to me rant and then chime in with hilarious wit about our shared, nearly vain efforts to teach. So how did the distinguished English gentleman end up in Asia in his waning years? Mr. Semper sat down in the lawn chair and told me his tale.
Born in the UK, in a little town in the south of England called Romsey in 1946. The eldest of six, born to a native mother, and my father was an immigrant from Southern Ireland. So the long history of traveling around is in my bones.
Let's talk about Ireland. Did your dad talk about it a lot when you were growing up?
Yes, he until his dying day, even though he first arrived in England in 1936, he never praised the English. He was always anti-English.
So why did he move to England?
Money.
And he married an English woman.
Yeah.
So he must have found one good one.
Yeah. It's called the chain migration, where they move out from poverty, but they have a link in the new destination. The people from the community just keep moving out of the desperate situation they were in, because his grandfather was born in the year of the potato famine, 1865. So there's a long history and memory of poverty and death, starvation. But he lived in England for the rest of his life. He would recount stories of his childhood, which were never really happy.
Yeah.
Always very critical of his father, whom he didn't get on with. He, like me, was the eldest. And I think the eldest child is always at a disadvantage, because the other kids follow on, and You're often left to your own devices, which I certainly was, and I guess he was.
What's something you remember him saying about his childhood? Anything specific?
Well, he didn't go to school very often. He had to look after the animals because they had a small hole in a little farm. And he, being the eldest, was required to do the jobs. His father spent a lot of time in England earning money and sending it back. They lived down a little lane, and the post box was at the end of the lane, so they had to walk some distance to collect the letters. And his mother would send him up to the post box. And when he got to the post box, and he'd shout back, "There's a letter from England." His mother would shout, "Open it. Is there any money in it? No, we'll throw it away then."
Really?
My mother was in the Women's Royal Air Force in the war. And my father was an itinerant worker, often working on the land.
This is World War II, right?
Yeah. And he dodged the call-up. He didn't want to fight for the English, but because he was resident, he was liable. So he dodged the call-up until about 2 years before the end of the war. And he got caught with another couple of his colleagues. And they were put into some police station. And very, very lucky for him, the police officer in charge was from Ireland. And he said, "You don't want to fight for the English, Paddy, do you?" He said, "No." He said, "Off you go." And he let them go. So he was very lucky. But his father was liable for service in England in the First World War. And he didn't want to fight for England. So he went to America. and the Americans captured him, and he was signed up into the American Army.
Really?
But he never saw active service, but my grandmother received a pension from the American government until she died in 1976.
Huh.
Tremendous, if you think. I don't know how much she got, but she always used to look forward to the pension because she smoked Craven A cigarettes, and she used to smoke them, she said, on the pension.
There you go.
Yeah.
So what about your childhood? Well, first of all, how did your parents meet?
I never knew. I guess it, probably in a pub. Mother wasn't the most beautiful woman, and I guess she'd have been flattered, the attentions of my father, who was 2 years older than her. And she became pregnant, and they got married in July 45, and I arrived in February 46, a complete mismatch. They were always fighting, but mother loved him without a doubt. But he wasn't a womanizer in any way at all, but he was just irresponsible, big gambler, and they were always arguing and fighting about money. My younger brother was still wetting the bed when he was 11, and I was sharing the bed with him, so I'm 13. So that was it. But there was three of us born in 2 years and 8 months. My mother had three children. That was up into 1948. I can remember when I was three, my earliest memories of us being put in at like a pen in the garden in the summertime. And I was told that I ran away when I was that age to go and see my grandparents. And I walked across the field. They were farmers. And I was in with a bull. And they had to get a man on a tractor to go and get me because the bull was dangerous. I've no memory of that, but I've memories of other things. Of course, at that age, you don't realize it's a poor existence. But looking back, I have a photograph of myself, my sister, and my younger brother. And it was taken when we were about 7 years old. And I said to my sister, "Why were we smiling?" And she said, she wrote back and said, "No idea," she said, "but they were desperate days." But in common with many other people, immediately after the war in England, it was tough. But because we were the sons of an Irishman, he moved to a small village in Hampshire, and we were never accepted. We were always considered to be Paddy's sons. Roman Catholics. I think there was maybe two families who were Roman Catholic in the village. I remember meeting a girl whose father was an engineer for the local council. And she agreed to go out with me. And I owned a car at that time. I was 18. And I remember knocking on the door on a Saturday evening. And her father answered the door and said, "You're not taking my daughter out."
So you knew.
Yeah. And I recounted that tale to another lad I went to school with in the village. I met him probably 15 years ago and was recounting this story. And he said, "Yes, that's the way it was."
Yeah. You know, I was in your country for a short time, and I was surprised about, even within England, the, like, one town to another, there would be this bitterness or this irritation. Like, don't talk to that guy. He's from, you know, the next county over.
There was an old man in the village, and you said about inter-town rivalry. It was a lot nearer inter-village rivalry. And he was the oldest person in the village, except for this woman who used to be an ambulance driver called Miss Wall. And someone said to him one day, "Miss Wall, in her 90s then, is the oldest resident of Broughton, the village we were in." And old Herbie said, "No, she ain't. I am." They said, "No, she's older than you." "Yes," he said, "but she wasn't born in the village. So she didn't qualify." So
That's funny.
Narrow-minded.
Yeah. But now, these days, I mean, because you haven't been back a whole lot in the last... That is not... the case anymore, do you think? Or
I would guess there's still pockets of it, but it's opened up a lot more now with people having more money and the affluent south. Mm-hmm. In the village that I was raised in, there are now people with a lot of money. Greg Dyke, who used to be the chairman of the BBC, mm-hmm. he actually lives in the village now. So it you've got a lot of outsiders coming in there now, but only people with money.
Sure.
It's a common problem now that the locals can't afford the properties.
Sure. The you have property taxes there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are they yearly?
Yes. Oh. Well, you pay monthly, but yeah, they're yearly. Yeah. The house I had in Norwich, I looked recently on the internet, and it's over £2,000 a year just for tax.
It's a problem in the States also.
Yeah.
Someone maybe built their own house, been there forever, and then also they can't afford it because it's probably, it's one of my pet peeves.
We're in the jailhouse now.
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 They told us once or twice to quit playing cards and shooting dice. We're in the jail.
You had a stint as a prison guard.
I like the word stint. 26 years is a stint.
So, first of all, why did you take the job?
Very simply, the job, I got involved with a married woman for my sins who had a couple of kids. And she became pregnant. And the prison service offered a free house. And it was as simple as that. Uh-huh. So I applied and was accepted in 1968.
Now, when you say free house, like, were there other houses around that were all people who worked for the prison?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
They were on an estate. They were specifically just belonged to the Home Office, prison houses, because if they had any problems, then they needed to get you into the prison quickly, so they knew where you were.
Right.
In fact, you had to get permission if you wanted to live in your own house, if you wanted to buy your own house.
Really?
And you were financially penalised if the prison had a house that was empty, but you were living in your own house.
Oh, yeah.
They would stop your rent allowance.
Wow.
I remember a tale about the hospital officer once, and it was a bitterly cold night, and there was a problem inside the prison, and one of the officers came and knocked on the door, and his wife opened the bedroom window. This was sometime in the small hours of the morning, and the officer shouted up, "Is hospital officer whoever in the house?" She said, "No, he's gone fishing." And he said you could hear him snoring in the bedroom, but he wasn't going to come out.
So I assume if these guys break out of the prison, like y'all's homes are like the first they're going to hit, or if they were going to hit any homes.
No, they wouldn't bother. They want to get away as fast as they can.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they're not after revenge?
No,
Did you have escapes very often?
Not very often. It did happen, but it was...
How did it happen?
Various ways. They would smuggle themselves onto a van, which was leaving. Mm-hmm. Maybe a van that came in to pick up rubbish from the kitchens for the pigs, mm-hmm. called the swill man. And they would hide in one of the bins. And you only knew they'd escape when you had a roll call at lunchtime or in the evening. Funnily enough, I worked in an open prison in Lincolnshire in 1988, and they were free to go, but these were prisoners who were sort of white collar criminals, mm-hmm. solicitors and policemen and people like that. But I remember this chap escaping, and he came back because Lincolnshire was very flat and mm-hmm. very rural, agricultural, and he couldn't find his way anywhere. And the only thing he could see was the lights of the prison. So he came back to the prison covered in mud.
Did he get in trouble?
Yeah, well, yeah, he'd lose remission for that.
Yeah.
But it's all changed. Towards the end of my service, it's changed for the worse, I'm told. And I met an officer. Okay. I'd left the prison service about 5 years, and he said to me, "You remember when you were in the service?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Halcyon days compared to now." And it's changed dramatically.
Why has it gotten worse, do you know?
Yeah, drugs, big problems.
Yeah, yeah.
Untrained staff on low money, so they're not committed in any way at all, and so they're ripe for corruption.
So what's the wildest thing you saw as a prison guard?
I worked in Holloway Prison where the women were. We used to have to go down there for a week at a time, two of us, just to maintain order. And we worked in the wing where we had all the women who were in for murder. And a lot of them were in there for killing their kids.
Wow. We don't get those stories in America. We have our own troubles, but we never hear about foreign countries. And
well, there was a case, I think you might have been here early in your tenure here, where someone went into a kindergarten and killed a few kids.
There were several, though, they were copycats. Like, yeah. They were knifing kids.
Yeah. Yeah, but they were all executed within days.
Yeah. And I wonder why, because it's hard to, you know, with the media here, you never know exactly. You'll never get the truth.
No.
You know, it was always a motive for something, but
I think probably most of them, I would guess here, are mentally ill. We used to work in a wing where there was seven of them for observation. And they had a TV up on a plinth.
Right.
And they sat around in a semicircle on wooden chairs. And, of course, there can only be one program on at a time.
Right.
And I remember this woman didn't want the program on. Mm-hmm. So we said, well, have a vote. Mm-hmm. Who wants this and who wants that? And she was on her own. So she picked up her chair and smashed the TV. Of course, then they're all running after her to kill her. So we have to intervene, lock her up, then lock the others up. And we came back the next day. There's a new TV there from the social people. Yeah, so, and this was the beginning of the slippery slope.
Prison escapes.
Yeah, High Point in Suffolk. A lot of these prisons were built on old, disused RAF stations, and so they were high altitude and very open. To test the security, they put some SAS men in there, and I'm told that they escape within minutes.
That's great. Okay, cool.
She knows I'm a deserter from the Scottish Fusiliers. She knows I stole a blind man's can. That got me 7 years. She knows I've been connected with a gang of West End pests. And the police have had me twice inside the cage.
How does that affect your mental state? You know, I know that, especially in the States, like, I have some friends that are cops. Some of them don't do real well mentally, I don't think, because all they see is bad, the worst of the worst all day long. Yeah. And maybe same with any kind of people, like social work and all that. Do you feel it affect your slant on life at all? Or?
You become very cynical.
Sure.
Trust no one.
Yeah.
And mind you, that's put me in good stead for the rest of my life.
Especially living in Asia.
It's true. Yeah. Yes, it's a tremendous skill to have, because in Asia, I've been here now in Asia almost 12 years now, and in Thailand in particular, living in a small area, I have seen so many Westerners, not necessarily English, but Americans and Germans, who have just messed it up, lost all their money, and they've all gone. And there's just me and another lad from England who have been there for any long period of time.
Right.
So, and I've only survived because I just trust no one.
Mm.
But these other people, they're more trusting because they haven't seen the degree of badness that exists within the prison population.
Do you feel that affects your like life of family as well?
It can do, yeah. But you have to be aware of it, which I am.
Sure, yeah.
You've just got to try and switch off.
Uh-huh.
Although in the prison it wasn't easy. It was cold, but it was the most dangerous job in terms of people dying early. Only one in three lived longer than 6 months after retirement.
Really?
And we retired at, it didn't say what age, because you could retire at 55, which was 10 years before the normal age.
So they did allow, they knew that
It was the most stressful job in the country.
Yeah. Well, you've beat the odds.
Yeah.
Because you're in your 60s, right?
Yeah, I'm almost 67 now.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah, I've had, since 95, so I've had 17 years.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask you one more question about the prison. Did you ever watch over any famous criminals, ones that were notorious? Or?
Yeah, in the women's prison, Myra Hindley. The Moors murderess, famous with Brady.
Okay, so tell what happened with that.
She and her boyfriend, Ian Brady, who's still alive and still in prison, They abducted children and tortured them, recorded them being tortured, then murdered them. And of course, it was allowed them to have sex. Oh. It was a stimulant for them to have sex, listening to the torturing.
Oh, good Lord.
And they buried the kids on the moor, Saddleworth Moor.
Wow.
And there was one lad called Bennett, I think he was about 16 or 17. They've never found him. And his mother died last year.
Oh.
And she went to her grave, still not knowing where he was. Right. And Brady, from within prison, played with her. He said he's here and he's there, and they tried to find him, but they never did. So they're psychopaths.
Oh, man.
But she got an officer of the sack, a female officer, because she had a lesbian relationship with this woman and didn't get what she wanted, so she reported the officer, who ended up getting 7 years in prison.
We're all going on a summer holiday. No more working for a week or two. Fun and laughter on a summer holiday. No more worries for me or you for a week or two.
Now, let's talk about your travels. You have wandered around.
Yeah, my travels started within the prison service. I worked in a unit where we used to escort mentally ill deportees back to their country of origin. And my first trip was to California, to the lettuce growing area called Salinas. And that was my first time, A, on an aeroplane, and B, out of Europe.
So, out of curiosity, how did this American end up in Britain, and what did he do?
A lot of them come over on a tourist visa. They've got a history of mental illness, and they don't take their medicine. They break down in England because it's strange, they're not in familiar surroundings. And they overstay their visa, and eventually they commit a crime because they run out of money, stealing. Police pick them up. Who are you? So they're illegal. They put them into Pentonville Prison, and we assess them and liaise with the authorities from whichever country they come from, and escort them back, because airlines won't allow a mentally ill person to be unescorted on a plane.
I understand.
So we ended up traveling all over the world.
So that was a pretty good gig, considering.
Yeah, okay, good.
Now, did you, when you went to these places, did you get a few days to look around, or?
Yeah, often we had to book a flight when we got there, so we could often, if we went to some exotic place, and we used to go to quite a few exotic places, we'd stretch it for maybe a 5-day stint.
Yeah.
Come back nicely tanned in the wintertime.
Well, what was the best place you visited when you had to take a prisoner back?
Well, memorable was we were flying down in December to Sierra Leone. And Sierra Leone is quite interesting because the airport is on an island and you have to get a ferry over to the actual mainland. And Sierra Leone, again, was an old English colony, so it's familiar, they can all speak English. But we just got into the flight and we sit at the back and we put the prisoner, or the deportee, he's not a prisoner, against the window, and he's near the toilet. And the person with me was in charge of the escort, and he allowed him to buy a whiskey. And the prisoner was doodling, and he asked to go to the bathroom. And he walked to the front of the plane and held up a placard saying that these officers at the back of the plane have been brutalizing me whilst I've been in Pentonville Prison. And the officer with me said, "What do you think we should do now?" And we were having a meal. I said, "I suggest you eat the meal as quickly as you can," I said, "because you won't be eating any more for the rest of this trip." And we had to go up and manhandle the man down the aisle of the airplane. We're now flying over the Bay of Biscay, somewhere like that. And the stewardesses were shouting at us, "What's going on?" And we told them who we were, and then they realized who we were, because they didn't know where we were, but now they knew. And there was a person on the plane from the Sierra Leone High Commission who came back and spoke to the prisoner in no uncertain terms. And he behaved himself for the rest of the flight. But other officers on other escorts had incidents as well with prisoners on planes.
Man, that'd be stressing me out.
Yeah. I was actually in Lebanon and walked past the American Embassy. And whilst I walked further into the where the beach was, they blew the American Embassy up. I was
really?
There that day, yeah.
Wow.
And I walked past it, yeah.
So you heard the explosion?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Wow, that's something else, man.
Didn't know what was going on
because
it was a war-torn place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when we went, I went back there when it was much worse. And I remember seeing the Holiday Inn there, all dotted with bullet holes. And we went to see the English ex-Battle of Britain war pilot called Jackie Mann, who had a pub there. And he later on was captured by the Hezbollah people. But I remember walking around Beirut, we were there, and we could hear pop, 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 pop. And my colleague said to me, "What's that?" I said, "That's gunfire." I said, "Get back to the hotel as quickly as you can." Yeah, but it's still a wreck, the place.
Yeah, it used to be a great country, and just
it was the tourist destination of the rich,
right.
Because you could be sunbathing, and an hour away you went up into the hills for skiing, called the Cyprus hills or something, Cyprus Heights. Yeah, they said you can be skiing up there and you can see the people sunbathing on the beach.
Wow,
a lot of it attributed to the British interfering, redrawing. Boundaries, and if you look at the involvement of Lawrence of Arabia, who had a great understanding of what was going on there, and suggested that Damascus be the capital and unite the people, and it was rejected by these boffins in Britain, and it's now being seen that his idea was probably right. He understood the Arabs.
Tuo palo americano, americano, americano. Sienta me quito papa.
When did you decide to become a teacher in Asia?
First of all, when I left England in 2000, I went to Cyprus and realized that it wasn't for me, because, as I said earlier, it's predominantly a place for retired couples. And I went back to England for Christmas, and a mutual friend turned up and suggested that if I wasn't happy, why didn't I look at Thailand? From Cyprus, I went to look at Thailand, and I booked a holiday in February, my birthday, end of February, so I thought I'll have a holiday over my birthday. And I booked a trip for 3 weeks, and I ended up staying 10 weeks. I was just infatuated by the place. And I went back to Cyprus, back to Thailand, back to Cyprus.
What did you like about Thailand?
It was cheap, the weather, the women. It was just a holiday, you know, a constant holiday.
All right.
The beaches are fantastic.
Does the country work or not? Does it function?
It functions. It's if they didn't have any sunshine, if it wasn't because of its geographical location, in other words, they'll never die of hypothermia. So they've no desire or incentive to be anything but bone idle, and most of them are bone idle.
Right.
Food is readily available, it drops out of the trees, so they don't have to do anything.
And they survive on tourism as a country.
Someone said to me, the Thais haven't invented anything, and I said, they have. What's that? I said, they've invented the truth. They do that every day. For them, lying is a way of life.
Okay, so you're in Thailand, and you're not married at this point. You're divorced, right?
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to teach there?
I decided to rent a house there. It was a year's rent in Phuket, a place called Kamala. So I had not a very rigid routine, but a routine in the day of getting up and going down to the beach around just before midday, lounging on a lounger, go in, have a little dip, come out, order some food, lounge again, and take some books with me, try and learn a bit of Thai, and go back to the home.
I mean, I don't mean to be nosy about your budget, but you could do this for until
I die.
Until you die.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I did that for about 3 or 4 months, and I thought, this is just the same as a job. It was so boring after a while. It was the same. And when I tell people that who are still working, they think you're mad.
Yeah, yeah.
But I could do whatever I wanted, and I just got sick and tired.
You're a workhorse, probably.
So with a degree, I knew there was teaching jobs in Thailand. So I went on enrolled on a TEFL course, which was held in Phuket. Uh-huh. And one of my colleagues on the course, he was living up in Chat Ham. And he said, why don't you come up here for Christmas? So I went up to Chat Ham for Christmas. Liked it. It's much more quiet, not as expensive, uh-huh. Lovely little area. And I thought, this suits me. So I rented a house there as well.
Let's talk about teaching specifically.
You can embrace Thailand very briefly. They do have the same problem, in my opinion, that they have a no-fail policy.
Everybody passes.
Yes, oh. Eventually. Which defeats the object.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same here, and it's frustrating.
Yeah, because the selective sieve exists in any walk of life. Mm-hmm. No matter where you go, there is selection, so...
I'll say this, my students came to me, who were good students, but they were concerned about one of their classmates who kept failing. I'd failed them like 3 times.
Yeah.
And they said, why can't you just pass them? I said, if I hated China, I would pass them, because it means I don't care.
Yeah.
I just want anybody to graduate, and I want to go out and become a surgeon or
go
build buildings, and knowing he would just go kill Chinese people and make buildings that would fall down. So.
Yeah.
And they understood it when I put it that way, but they had never thought of it that way,
So. I remember a student in Thailand, he was probably into his 5th year of a 3-year course, kept repeating it, and he came to me with an interpreter. He still couldn't speak English.
Yeah.
And said, could I look upon him favorably and pass him? And I said, easily. I'll pass you, providing you give me 1,000 baht, which is £20. Uh-huh. And this was in front of other teachers. Uh-huh. Obviously, I was joking. Uh-huh. And he put his hand in his pocket and dragged out 1,000 baht.
Yeah, that's what you got.
That's Thailand. But here, last year, I failed 2 boys who turned up on a 16-week course for probably 3 periods each. And I failed them because they're lazy, and my assessment is based on the whole of the course. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't there for a lot of the tests I gave them, so I had no way of assessing their English ability. Mm. And I haven't been asked to retest them in any way at all.
Do you think they just got passed anyway?
That I don't know, because I asked the girls in the class, was it me? Did uh-huh. they not turn up for my class? They said, no, they don't turn up for any classes.
Right.
So they're just lazy.
Yeah. They're down at the internet bar, probably. That's where most of mine are that don't come up. You know, in China, it's you have to be 18 to be able to go to the internet bar. So a lot of them, as soon as they turn 18,
right,
they hit the internet bars because they haven't been able to go till now.
Yeah, so it defeats the object. But I had a nice compliment from one of the senior teachers over there, a man, who doesn't teach much. He's retired. Mm-hmm. But one of his jobs is to go around and check that the teachers are on duty. And I said, why do you have to do that? He said, a lot of the Chinese teachers just don't turn up, he said.
What, do the students just sit there with no teacher?
I guess they do initially and then disappear, but it's a question of paying them, I suppose.
Yeah.
But he said to me, he said, you are a very respected teacher. He said, you're very knowledgeable. And he said, we hope you stay in China for a long time. And I thought, you know, for me, that's good.
Yeah, it's great, but it's sad that nothing against you, but the bar is so low.
Yeah.
Just a guy who shows up and knows a couple of facts would be the star teacher.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. The Thais have no desire for any meaningful educational system. It's mm-hmm. just it's a money-making, business-orientated mm-hmm. venture.
But it's not even productive, like?
None at all.
Okay.
They're one of the lowest achievers in the world in any academic subject. I actually wrote in, and it was published in the national press in Thailand about it, and said several reasons that until the no-fail policy is dispensed with, the corruption is dispensed with, that you will carry on mm-hmm. being in the bottom, in the relegation zone forever.
Yeah. Do you feel the Thai are proud people?
They've lots of pride, uh-huh. but no shame.
Gotcha.
The big problem with the Thai is this P mentality, and P is the older one. You always suck up to the older one. The older one, you never question the older one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They never question the teachers. Uh-huh. This lot don't question the teachers.
Yeah,
and I instill into them,
yeah.
ask me questions,
yeah.
and they now do. They know me.
Yeah.
I remember a chap fixing computers, mm-hmm. And he had a deal with a woman that, it, because she was a good bricklayer, she could lay bricks, and he wanted her to build a wall for him. Mm-hmm. And she took her older cousin or whatever down. And because her older cousin was P, her older cousin said, I'm going to build the wall. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't lay the thing. And it turned out to be just a pig's ear of a joke. And he was really pissed off that he'd given her a computer and fixed everything for her. For the wall, and the wall was a bag of shit. Yeah. But the reason was because the builder wouldn't argue with the older one.
Yeah.
And with me, the younger one is always called Nong. Mm-hmm. And I call everyone Nong. Mm-hmm. And at my age, I can get away with it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some guy 50, and I say Nong, because it's quite, you know, I'm telling you, it's like saying, hey, you, boy, come here, Nong, and they turn around and they accept it. Sometimes you consume.
So when you first came to China and you started to teach a class, I mean, were you surprised? Were you shocked, I mean?
Well, the first place I taught was south of Luoyang, in a place called Nanyang, where I was teaching students who want to be teachers. So the level was higher there. Mm. It was a normal university.
Mm. It's normal.
Yeah, I like that word.
Yeah, for the people listening, they actually have... universities called, like, for example, like Luoyang Normal University. Yeah. That is the name of the place.
Yeah, it's an oxymoron. Normal. But they were much better. And I had groups of 12 students. It was a doddle. So I sat them in a horseshoe shape, and we just read and did things that were interesting. And I only had 6 months of that. There was a job advertised in Luoyang. Went into the classrooms, and a bit, obviously from 12, I'm now into 30, and I was amazed with the first years, just a complete lack of understanding of any English from me whatsoever. Mm-hmm. A few students would get a bit of it. Mm-hmm. One of the spokespersons stood up and said, excuse me, mm-hmm. can you speak Chinese? I said, but my English is okay. So... And I knew exactly why she said it. I said, why? She said, well, we don't understand you. And I said, I don't understand your Chinese either. I said, so what are we going to do about it? I said, I'll tell you what we'll do. I said, I will continue speaking English. I am deliberately speaking slowly at the moment, though you don't understand that. Uh-huh. And I said, after 3 or 4 months, you'll be amazed. Uh-huh. Because I said, I'm the first native speaker that you've ever listened to. As a teacher, yes, they said. I said, so, yes, but you will tune into me. Uh-huh. And I reminded them at the end of the semester. I said, do you remember? They said, yeah. I said, how are we now? They said, yeah, you're right. I said, I know. Yeah. That's the way it works. Uh-huh. I said, if I could speak Chinese, it's self-defeating.
Right.
I watched a woman yesterday teaching, and I said afterwards to the two students, I said, 70% of that lesson was in Chinese. Uh-huh. It's pointless. Yeah. But when I test them here, initially, they didn't understand, but I put them in rows, in numerical order, 1 to 6, 7 to 12, 13 to 18, 19 to 24, and 25 to 30. And I do it because I can then collect my papers in order, and I know who's written on my paper, because that is sacrilege, in my opinion, and they have to go and get a copy. Whereas if they're randomly around, I don't know who it is.
Right.
But it does keep order, and I give them a different paper, so they can't copy from each other. Right. And it eliminates the random high scores that you get. Three boys sitting at the back all get about 28 out of 30, and I know they're not 28 out of 30. So when I sit them in a row, back to reality, down in the lower 18s, I notice one girl... A couple of weeks ago, she's clever, but I gave her this TEM4 paper, all of them, and I watched her. She was on the mobile phone all the time. Uh-huh. She never even looked at the screen, and she got 100%. And when I got up to, and she passed her paper to a boy, and I saw them, and I just watched, and he was passing it back, and he looked at me, and I went, I said, you got 100%? He only got 24 out of 30.
Even with the cheating?
Yeah, I said, how dumb are you? I said to her, how dumb are you? And I said to her, I said, I know what you've done. I can't prove it. But I said, next time, I said, I'll get you. A tie told me how they cheat. Multiple choice. They have a prearranged signal. A, B, C, D.
So they're tapping their elbows and their shoulders.
Yeah, so they know.
Wow. One girl I noticed was looking at the wall on occasion.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm far away. I can't really see. After the exam was over, I went over and looked, and everything was written on the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had come to class beforehand and written in ink.
Yeah. I had some Matium 1. They're 12-year-old kids in Thailand. I was teaching them maths. Mm-hmm. And in Thailand, because they cheating is a way of life, I made every third row a different paper. Mm-hmm. So they were well away from the person with mm-hmm. a similar paper. Mm-hmm. And two girls came up to me who were sat adjacent to each other mm-hmm. and said, excuse me, they call you Ajahn mm-hmm. for the teacher. Excuse me, Ajahn, yeah. We've got different papers. Really? I said, you mean you've looked at your colleague's paper already? And they realized and ran away and sat down. And I said, in the West, if you cheat, mm-hmm. I said, you get a zero. Mm-hmm. But I said, the person you copied from also gets a zero. Mm-hmm. Oh, really? And within minutes, two more from the back, one, excuse me, we haven't got the same paper. Really? I said, I can't believe it. You've actually looked at each other's. Oh, boom, gone.
Okay, well, we've talked about all the negative aspects, but obviously on occasion you come across like a bright star or a bright light, I should say, or someone who it's really sad they're stuck in the system.
Yeah.
So tell me something about this.
I met one last year. All my new entrants, the first years, I give them all an initial test just for my own sake to find out if they've got any English in them at all. Mm-hmm. And this girl got 100%. Mm-hmm. And being the cynic that I am, my initial reaction was, how did she cheat on that? But it turned out she's the brightest kid I've ever met in China. Mm-hmm. And I went to the office because I asked her before. I said, why are you here?
For the record, the school that we were at, the bar is pretty low. Yeah. It's like the last stop. Like if you couldn't make it in some other schools, you had to come here. So.
Yeah. But she was advised to stay on another year, but her father didn't want her to. Stay on another year in high school mm-hmm. and get a better mark in the national test, the Gaokao or whatever it's called. So she came here and realizing how bright she was, I went to the office, didn't name her, but asked if there was any way a student who would appear to have slipped through the net could be placed somewhere else. In the West, they can. Mm-hmm. And the answer I got was, no, she's here for 4 years. I said, okay. She came to me at the end of the semester and said, I'm sorry, I won't be coming to you this next semester. And I thought she was fed up with it. Uh-huh. So I said, okay, what's the problem? She said, they're moving me to another university, to Kaifeng. So I said, great, fantastic. I said, keep in touch. She said, yeah, I appreciate your help. But when I came back here in after the summer recess, I got a message from her. Her father wouldn't let her go.
What?
She's back here. And she was depressed. And
What was his purpose for that?
I don't know. They just, well, you know. And this girl that I was just talking about, she's gone backwards this year a little bit.
Mm,
and I was talking to the two yesterday who were in her group, and I said, in my opinion, she's probably still depressed. Mm-hmm. That she's had an opportunity that's been, the rug's been pulled from under her feet.
You know, they're shooting themselves in the foot because this girl's going to have to take care of them when they're older. And if she's been stunted educationally, it's less money for them.
Yeah.
It's, what people will do because of pride.
Yeah. I got a lot of them to write last year about their life, mm-hmm. that what they remember. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most of them never had any toys. They used mm-hmm. to play with mud.
Right.
And as you said about poverty, when you read that, you just can't believe. I mean, I came from, I said to you earlier, it was poor, uh-huh. not poverty, poor. But this is poverty.
Yeah.
I had an interesting piece submitted by a boy who wrote about the TEM4 test they take next April. Uh-huh. And he said, we were sat in the dormitory discussing the TEM4. And we said how bad it was at 50% here fail. Uh-huh. What's the point? The system's all wrong. Uh-huh. And he said, one of my colleagues said, well, it's not too bad. Mm-hmm. And this was in good English. Uh-huh. He turns out he's an A student. Uh-huh. He said, it's not too bad. He said, What we can do when we fail and we go back to the village looking after the pigs mm-hmm. is teach the pigs to speak English. And he said, when you do that, boy, we'll earn some money.
You're charging students on this? Yeah. Well, that's great.
I've kept it. Wow. And I took it back to Thailand.
Oh, that's great.
And they said, that's fantastic.
Yeah, good.
There's humour in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's writing in English.
Good. Well, he's going to go somewhere if he gets in the right place.
He's got something about him, hasn't
yeah,
he?
That's yeah, that's great.
Maybe one reason Mr. Semper seemed to be so vibrant in spite of his situation is that he had a brilliant and much younger Thai wife and two adolescent daughters. I asked Mr. Semper, how did he end up with a new family so late in life?
I was invited round by the college because I had a car, a pickup truck. They wanted me to take some material to a show, uh-huh. and my to-be wife was there. And they invited me round for a meal. And there was her and I and another couple. And they phoned me up and they invited me. There's quite a lot of girls in the bars, their birthday, so they have a party. Mm-hmm. And there was a party in this bar, and I was invited. And I said, we'll Lan will be there. And they said, oh yeah, she's up for it. So she turned up and I said to her, do you fancy coming out for a meal? She said, yeah. So took her for a meal on the Thursday and she came round with the couple again to my place. I cooked them a meal on the Saturday and that was it. We haven't been apart since.
Now, I remember you telling me you dated one of her friends before all this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was messing me around. Yeah, the girl in the office, there was three of them, uh-huh. all pretty little things. And the one, her colleague, called Ma'am, she said to me, Terry, bye-bye, made it obvious that she was interested. Uh-huh. And I took her out a few times. But unbeknown to me, she'd already got a French boyfriend living with him, but she was obviously wanting to move on. And I found out and I just told her bye-bye and she was upset about that.
I think you told me this other girl like sent you bad text messages because yeah. you were dating her friend.
Yeah, so I was having a party and I invited her to the party and I got the reply. It said, go f*** yourself. So I sent a text message back. An English teacher, I must correct your English. It should be go f*** yourself.
Did she respond?
No.
Okay, so you're in Thailand, and of course, eventually you get married, and
yeah.
and you have a couple of children.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, that's got to be something, starting a family. You were in your 50s at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, more
well, that was that in the plans?
No, not planned at all, but my wife had never been married before, no kids, and she wanted kids, mm-hmm. so it would be very selfish of me to object sure. to that.
So how's it been so far?
It's a complete life change for me.
Yeah.
I just adore the kids. Uh-huh. My life is for them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why I'm here. I'm not here for me, I'm here for them. So I make sacrifices for them. They don't appreciate it, but they're kids. I'm just trying to give them some skills that they can use
right.
in a later life.
Sure, Mr. Semper can seem like a grizzled old curmudgeon, but he insisted to me that humanity actually wasn't all that bad. His evidence? An incident he had in a Chinese shop specializing in mostly defective products.
I bought a set of scales yesterday from Splendid and took them back home. They don't work.
Oh, no.
159 RMB. So I went back today with the box. I went and checked the ones I got, where I got this from, and none of them worked.
Really?
So I said, what about one here, mm-hmm. cheaper one? And that worked. And I got her to get on it, and she's about 65. And I said, ooh, eat too much.
Did she laugh?
She was laughing. She didn't want to get on because she knew she was fat.
Oh.
And I got her, I lifted her. I said, get on there. And yeah. she got on there. So
they're not so sensitive about being fat over here.
No.
Not like the West, where the people just cry if you mention it.
But she stuck with me, took it back to the checkout. And of course, what I had to do then was to go downstairs with my receipt. Uh-huh. Get the 159 RMB back, uh-huh. then go up and buy the new one. That was the procedure. So it worked, and she stuck with me all the time. And when I got back to the checkout just to finalise, it's all done. She was done. I just tapped her on the shoulder and I said, "Yes, you." You know, she's like, no problem.
Yeah.
They're good like that. As my ex-father said to me a long time ago, most people in the world are good people. He said, otherwise it wouldn't work. And they are. They're good people.
Most people don't kill people. Most people don't start wars. Yeah. That's true. It's just a small percentage.
Yeah.
Now, you just speak English, but you've picked up some Thai
And
some Chinese, or?
Chinese, probably about 30 words.
Enough to get around.
Oh, yeah. I got enough, and I got my little tiny book.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Which I use, and I'm okay with that. I've no desire to learn Chinese for many reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The main one, I'm too old, and when I leave here, I've no intention of coming back. Mm-hmm. You're different. You're younger. Yeah. You might come back.
Yeah.
So it's something that you might use again. But for me, never. So why waste my time?
How do you order beer in Thai?
Kwat noi kap. Kwat means bottle. Beer chang, bottle, please. Yeah. Mi kwat yai, mi kwat lek. Kwat yai means big, and kwat lek means small. Tau rai kap means how much. And if they say it's too expensive, you say kwat lek, small one. Excuse me.
Okay, I think that's about it. We're going to say goodbye. Any last thoughts or words?
No, thanks for the chat and the reminiscing.
Yeah, thanks for going down memory lane.
Yeah.
You know.
In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And a special thanks to thebrofisticate.com.